Welcome to BGs and Me. I'm David Fedor. I am beyond excited to be talking today with the three authors of BGs Decades, a new book series about our favorite Brothers Gibb. This first book, focusing on their lives and work in the 1960s, will be available November 12th across the world and December 17th here in the States, right in time for Christmas, so get your orders in now. Let me quickly introduce you to my guests with info pretty much lifted from their website. The book, The Bee Gees in the 1960s, has left no stone unturned. In addition to getting to the bottom of all the information they could about these tracks, sessions, and albums spanning multiple decades, the three authors have also created a narrative that will make you feel closer to the Bee Gees and undoubtedly have a new perspective on the music, the story, and the legacy. Based in Wales, the United States, and Australia, respectively, Andrew Mon Hughes, Grant Walters, and Mark Crowan have over 14 decades of combined expertise and history tied to the Bee Gees' legacy between them, amassing a lengthy list of credits for their contributions to CDs, DVDs, books, tour programs, articles, television documentaries, and official websites. In the year 2000, Andrew and Mark co-authored the expansive biography, Tales of the Brothers Gibb. Andrew's expert contributions can be seen and heard in a myriad of Bee Gees-related productions for the BBC, ITV, A&E, and VH1 networks. Mark, the foremost expert in the Bee Gees' Australian era, gifted his collection to the Queensland Library in 2016. We're going to have to talk about that. Giving away your Bee Gees stuff, I don't know how that sounds. He contributed liner notes to the 1998 compilation Assault the Vaults. Grant is an award-winning freelance arts writer for the Columbus Underground and Albinism. I've said both of those wrong. Columbus Underground and Albumism, for which he has penned nearly 300 features since 2015. He is a prolific music interviewer, conversing with a diverse roster of artists, including Dionne Warwick, Midge Melissa Etheridge, Edie Brickell, and Brian Adams. Gentlemen, welcome to Bee Gees and Me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Good to be here.
It is an amazing time to be a Bee Gees fan, and you three gentlemen have a lot to do with that because of the new book, Bee Gees in the 1960s, a part of the series Bee Gees Decades. And Andrew, I understand that today, the day that we are filming this and recording this, you got a special shipment in the mail, coincidentally.
I got half a ton of books.
Congratulations.
This is it.
Oh, very nice. We haven't even seen this yet, so very nice.
No. This is an exclusive to Bee Gees and Me, the actual physical book.
So it's about
my name thick. Correctly, Andrew, because they didn't in the Russian version.
Yeah, Mark Cohen. Yeah, no, it's all right on this. It's all good. All good.
This book is not only for, you know, a general Bee Gees fan or somebody who might not know a lot about Bee Gees. People who know a lot about the Bee Gees will also love and find out new things in this book.
Yeah, there are things in there which we researched over a number of years. But even on the day that we submitted the final manuscript to the publisher, I had a last minute few discoveries of things, and he had to insert three separate paragraphs of additional text for us, even after I'd submitted the final manuscript, as it were. There's been a lot of research put into this since we did Tales back in 2000. And there was a lot of research went into that, of course. So the additional stuff that we have found since then should make for interesting reading for all these people that claim that, oh, there was nothing new in it. You know, there most definitely is. a lot of new stuff in here, and I'm sure people will be quite surprised at the number of photographs that we have in the book, which have never been seen before as well.
Yeah, it is quite exciting, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but I wanted to touch upon your BG fandom at the top of the show, because whenever I have people on, it's a lot of times people who are fans and people who are passionate about the Bee Gees. And one of the things that I know when I talk with people is getting that common bond about the origin story of how you become a fan. And first and foremost of, you know, everybody, and I know you three included, we're a fan of the music first. So let's go. I'd like to, you know, briefly talk with each of you about your, as I like to call it, your origin story. We'll go geographically. That's not a word. I'm talking to three authors.
Geographically?
Yeah. From the bottom or from the top?
Something. I think it's geographically.
Why don't you go by who became a fan first? I think that's probably the way to go.
That would be me. That would be me.
All right. Mark, we'll start with you then. Mark, you're in Australia, and geographically from me, you're the farthest. It sounds like as well. So, we'll either way, we'll go fan first. Mark, how did you first get into the Bee Gees?
Well, 66, and when I first heard Spicks and Specks, and whilst they'd been around for years, and I was quite into music because I had older brothers, I don't have any recollection of seeing them on the bandstands, etc. That they were obviously on many times, but Spicks and Specks for me, and I like that. I specifically love the sound of Barry's voice. Had a real tone I loved, and of course the harmonies. So I just loved that. I was a Beatles fan too, but the Beatles really struck me there from that point. Just Barry's voice and that unique harmony sound, and from then every song basically had that unique sound, and that's how I grew. Be a fan from there.
Wow. So that was almost day one. Now, do you think your fandom had a little bit, you know, extra to it because of the Australia connection as well?
Yeah, I would think so. It was interesting when they started to, I love Barry's voice, as I said, and I just, his tones, his richness, and you could almost sing anything. And so it was interesting also when they started in the falsetto, because I love Barry's natural voice. So it took me a little while to come to appreciate what a beautiful instrument his falsetto voice is. It can go anywhere. He can do things with his falsetto that he can't do with his natural voice. So, but yeah, certainly the Australian connection is you've got a role to play, and you actually know people who knew them then. And Andrew and I started a book some years ago called, we had a working title, The Australian Years, and a lot of this that is in this book too. So we did a lot of research for that, for this book, but just speaking to people who knew them then, and luckily we started then, because a lot of those people have passed who knew them when they were young. So we've luckily got a lot of interviews in over the last, even, you know, for book one, that people aren't there anymore.
Yeah. All right, Grant or Andrew, who started loving the Bee Gees first?
Well, since I am significantly younger, I think that would
be Andrew. I didn't want to say it.
Not significantly, but a little bit. Actually, Andrew and I weren't too far off, I think, when we started becoming fans. I was a bit younger, he was a bit older, but I think he's next, though.
Andrew, go ahead.
My first memory of hearing the Bee Gees was actually 1967, because living in Anglesey, we are due south from the Isle of Man, and we used to get particularly poor radio reception from the British stations, so we used to tune into Irish stations and or Manx Radio. And there were a number of songs from that era. You'd get things like Lily the Pink, and some of the Amen Corner stuff like High in the Sky. And there was a song called Massachusetts, which I distinctly remember hearing at that point. But, of course, like sort of being 2 years of age, and like sort of it didn't kind of, you know, make any significant impact on me at that point. It was only back in about 1979 when I bought the live album that I was going through the track listing on. I thought, Massachusetts? You're kidding me. So anyway, backtrack a little bit. It was Too Much Heaven that got me to start with. Went out, bought the Spirits Having Flown album. There was a little pamphlet inside of that which showed a number of the other albums. Went out, bought those. There was two best ofs. There was Best Of and Best Of Volume 2. I bought those and kind of figured that, hang on a minute, these songs must come from other albums which I don't have. Conveniently, there were a couple of budget LPs released in the UK called Massachusetts and Gotta Get a Message to You, the first editions of which had pictures of the missing albums. So go out, buy those, and so on and so forth. 1984, got a job, bought Record Collector magazine to try and find that one elusive album, which at that point was Cucumber Castle. But then started finding singles. So you'd find the German version of World, and then you'd see that there was a Dutch version of it. Oh, actually, that's a poor example because the picture sleeve's the same on those. But, you know, you'd find that the German picture sleeve was different to the French picture sleeve, which was different to the Norwegian picture sleeve, which was different to the Italian or the Spanish. And that's how I started getting into the collecting kind of side of things. It's been a long road for Andrew.
Good heavens.
I know. I feel like I'm on, Miss World or something like that, you know. It's been an incredible journey, you know.
So we'll go on to now Grant, who has yet to give his origin story. Grant, you said, you know, that you became a BG fan maybe around the same time as Andrew. When did you start getting into them?
Yeah, well, my story I think is a lot less traumatic than Andrew's is apparently. So we'll. So I became a fan of the Bee Gees very, very early on. I was very, very young, very little when I started hearing their songs and reacting to them. And so I think much like Andrew, I think the first time that I remember viscerally hearing on the radio was Too Much Heaven, probably late 1978. Early 1979, and I was only 2 or 3 years old at that point in time. And I do very much have those vivid memories of hearing that music. I know a lot of people say that might be impossible, but it's not. But my mom bought me the Tragedy single, and from there we bought the Spirits Having Flown album. My parents already had a pretty healthy record collection, so they had Main Course and Best of Bee Gees, Volume 1 and 2. They had Trafalgar. And so, you know, I began listening to all those records and loving those songs, you know, from a very, very early age. I didn't really get involved very much in the fan community until probably about 1993 or 94. It was right after Sizes and Everything came out. I was in college at that point in time, and the internet was still really, really new. I mean, not everybody even got an email address at that point in time. You had to apply for one specially. And I started noticing as I was, you know, sort of exploring what the internet was at that point, which was not very much, that a lot of artists had listservs that, you know, where fans discussed things. And it was sort of this free, you know, open forum for fans to come and discuss, you know, things about different artists and why they love the music and things. And I noticed the Bee Gees didn't have one at that point in time. So I went to our IT department and said, hey, I'd like to do this. I'd like to host a listserv. So I actually began what's now known as the Words listserv that's been around for now, I guess, almost 30 years. That now a gentleman named Chris Mathis runs that out of his system. But, you know, that was one of the first places that a lot of us really started to interact with one another. So it was a really fun thing to be a part of. It's where I started, you know, interacting with Mark and Andrew. And so that was kind of a fun, that was kind of a fun venue for all of us. And, you know, it still exists and people still use it, probably a little less so now with everything else that Facebook and social media has sort of provided. But, you know, it was one of the first places where all of us got together to talk about the music and why we loved it. And so that was,
fantastic.
Yeah.
And I can't say too much about it. It was just wonderful to connect through other fans. I'm like, you know, just wonderful. So. But I haven't said it before. Thanks, Grant.
Yeah, happy to do it.
So now we know that, you know, I'm segueing now into how the three of you got together to write this book. So tell me a little bit more about how the three of you connected for what was then one book.
Yeah. And you talk about how you started with Sonic Bond. I think that's probably where everything kind of began, right?
Yeah. A couple of friends of mine, Keith and Monica Damone, during the COVID lockdown, they wrote a book called On Track, Every Album, Every Song, about a group called Barclay James Harvest. And I ordered this book and saw that Sonic Bond Publishing, which is run by Stephen Lamb, very, very patient man, and I thought, well, I'm sure we could do a book about the Bee Gees. How hard can it be? You know, just reviewing every album and every song. So Stephen came back very positive, saying, yep, that's it, I will do that. So I got the deal, but I felt that I needed some help on it. So I knew that Grant was a good writer because of the stuff that he does for, what's it called? Albumism?
Albumism and Columbus Underground. So, yes, something like that.
You can't just make up a word and call it, like, that's albumism. That's, all right.
I'm sure the editor's going to love that. So.
I mean, you can write the word, and that's good. And everybody should go to that website and or physical publication.
It's a website, and yes, you should. Yes.
Andrew's our project leader. He can do what he wants.
So I asked Grant if he'd like to become involved, and I don't think I'd even press the send button, and I had a positive response. And Mark was then next on my hit list, because obviously I've worked closely with Mark for a long, long time, and we tend to work quite well together. Mark is a very, very good writer, but he really needs to learn about things like full stops, commas, exclamation marks, question marks, quotation marks. He writes the longest sentences in the world.
I take secret breath.
But I think we work well together, Mark.
But years ago, we'd spoken about doing after the 2000 Tales of the Brothers Gibb book finished, Andrew and I started working on a book called Song by Song, but we couldn't agree and sort of stopped. So I quietly kept going myself when I had a bit of time. But again, I've tailed off too. Mm-hmm. And then this project has, and then I think Andrew and Grant started off, and then I sent them, this is what I had, do what you want with it. But I hadn't done that much. But.
Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that. Well, sort of, and that is, yes, that was an absolutely invaluable injection into the initial project. Anyway, we started writing. Like, sort of, Stephen wanted between, 50 and 65,000 words. Like, sort of, to write about every album and every song by the Bee Gees. Mm-hmm.
And just listing the song titles and the albums might be that many words. Like,
well, I said to him, it might take a little bit more than that. Can we have 100,000 words? So he kind of went in an email. He kind of went like that. He had a sharp intake of breath, and he says, "Okay, let's sort of I'll run with it for now."
You would have got away with that without a punctuation you demanded.
We just smashed all the words together. We probably would have gotten to 100,000, right? No spaces, no paragraphs. Would have been great.
Yeah, I'm doing your punctuation request.
Anyway, I was trying to keep a track on word count as we were working along. And I think it was when we reached about 144,000 that I realized that we had a bit of a problem. So I spoke to Stephen about things, and he says, I've got an idea. He says, we'll split it. And I thought, right, okay, that's good. Because to me, there is a natural split in the Bee Gees' career. Like if you do 1963 to 1974, that's one part career. And then from 75 up to the present day, that's the other part. And conveniently, those two parts were fairly equal in terms of word count. Anyway, when I had a Zoom call with Stephen, he says, no, I want to split it into three. I want to put it into a different series of books. I don't want to put it into the on track. I want to put it into decades. So what we'll do is we'll do the Bee Gees in the 1960s, the Bee Gees in the 1970s, and then we'll do the Bee Gees in the 1980s all the way up to date. So I thought, okay, that works. Had a quick ponder over that one and got back to him a couple of days later. And I said, I think the 80s would stand alone. Because not only are we covering sort of the Bee Gees' actual recorded output, we're also going to cover the solo work. Plus, for the 80s, we obviously have the production work. So most people sort of would automatically reel off people like Barbara Streisand, Dionne Warwick, Kenny Rogers, and Diana Ross. But we mustn't forget the work that Robin did with Jimmy Ruffin. And Morris did with Carola Hagquist. Let's just say there's a lot of material in there. Let's just say the 80s will be a standalone book as well. And then the fourth book in the series will be the Bee Gees in the 1990s, up to date. So this current book is 256 pages plus 16 of pictures. And it's about 108,000 words. We did need to...
you hit the excessive amount of the word goal, it was just a fraction, a fourth of the career.
Yeah, we had to chop the epilogue, which covered 1970 up to date slightly. I do recall lots of the name of the file was quite interesting. When you edited that, Grant, can't remember what you said, hack job or something on it.
Something like that, yeah.
I
think it turned out okay, but obviously, you know, the epilogue that we wrote obviously was sort of to describe the rest of their career. And so, I mean, from 1969 on, that's a lot, you know. And so we felt there were tons of details that we wanted to include because, you know, you want to paint a picture. I mean, one of the most successful recording careers in music history. I mean, how do you sum that up in a couple of pages? And so we were asked politely to please cut it down just slightly. And so I'm happy with the edit that we made. But you know, it took some doing not to leave out some of the most important things because, you know, their career was so varied and nuanced and detailed, more so than I think a lot of people realize. And so, you know, it was difficult, but I think we did okay.
Well, presumably the people buying this will buy the next three books and won't need to rely on that epilogue, but you want to appeal to the people. You do want to appeal to the people who have only the one book. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Once you buy one, you sign up for all of them.
Once you buy one, Andrew shows up at your house with the rest and that's it.
What you need to do is go on one of those like PBS or BBC things where they show one night only, and then in between the songs they come in with a station break and be like, sign up now, and then you can receive this once a month. Get in the next book for your $30 donation a month.
It's like a set of steak knives, really.
I'll tell you what, as a fan of. I'm jumping ahead here. As a fan of the 90s and 2000s era, one of my biggest pet peeves is when that era gets glossed over. The 87 to 2003 era was, to me, you know, that was the part that I experienced that I remember. And I hate seeing that glossed over. So the fact that we're going to get, you know, a book focused on the 80s, a book focused on the 90s, a book, you know, that to me is so exciting. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to that. Now, in terms of this one, then, in terms of the writing, you guys obviously are passing, you know, a lot of emails back and forth and things like that. What were some of the fun things that you guys experienced and some of the maybe difficulties that you had writing a book on three separate continents during a pandemic?
Well, aside from punctuation, I can say issues, which are totally unnecessary, by the way. Let me say, I'd like to say one of the more difficult things I found is that sometimes you had no opinion about a song at all. If you liked the song, had no problem. If you didn't like the song, you didn't have a problem. But sometimes you're just ambivalent about it. But I found that personally difficult. The other issue when you had to write up a song like "Got to Get a Message to You," one of the classics, I felt a real responsibility to get that right. And like these are very subjective issues too, hearing. So I found that doing a classic was really, you walk around it and you do a little known song and you had to come back to, I've got to write this up. What am I going to say? Because this is going to be a definitive write up of this classic. I personally found that difficult.
There's a lot of responsibility there.
Well, I thought so, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, we had to be conscious of word limits and things like that too. So, we probably could have written books about entire albums, and spent a lot of time really, digging into those. So it was, when you're writing a book like this, you have to be conscious that, you have to write it for somebody who's picking it up for the first time and maybe doesn't know anything about, what you're writing about. And I don't know how many people there would be that would do that necessarily, but you can't make that assumption. And so, you have to include the details that I think are all very well known to many of us fans over the years. And so something that's common knowledge for, with the three of us might not necessarily be so for other folks. And so we had to write the book from that perspective, but also including, little, I guess, Easter eggs and gems for folks who, might not know certain things. One of the things I think was really interesting was writing in three different versions of English. And the three of us are, from different places. And, even though we speak a common language, I think there are, differences in our dialects and in our references and, how we write and things like that as well. Given that I've been living in the U.S. now for 20 years, I've taken out all of my U's and extra vowels. I used to write in Canadian, British, English, but I don't anymore. So, those little things.
The month comes before the date and that sort of stuff. My wife and I were watching Great British Baking Show. We had to put the subtitles on last night because of some of the people's accents. They were speaking English, but we had no idea what they were saying. And we literally turned the subtitles on to determine it. So
I remember when we did the book one, there was the word tosser came into it. The Bee Gees were called tossers, La Tossers at one point. And I remember Joe Brendan America went, "Well, what's a tosser?" And I'm going, and I'm saying from Australia, I think it's like a wanker with a nerd tone of it. They're coming back and explaining actually what La Tosser is. So we had this interesting discussion. Do you remember that, Andrew?
Yeah. Although we never did Zoom, did we? Not at all. No. We didn't have things like that back in 2000.
It was interesting. Like in Australia, you can call someone a bastard and it's okay. In other parts of the country, of the world, you can't. It's very. So we had. I do remember that conversation. What is what?
On the point of reviewing the songs, I've been looking through reviews of a lot of the other Sonic Bomb books, and some people have been saying that they don't agree with the writer's opinion of a certain song. I think we, having the three of us looked at each and every song, there's a more balanced view of that. As Mark says, like sort of somebody might not like the song at all, like, and somebody else might think really, really highly of it. One example, which immediately springs to mind for me, it doesn't appear in this book, it will appear in the next, is Tell Me Why from 2 Years On. I can't stand that song, but Mark loves it. So I'm not going to say anything about it. I'll leave that all up to him,
That's only because you've already said enough about it. I do remember, there was one song, and Andrew came back to me and said, "Oh, you've got to write more about it." I had nothing to give. I think Grant may have seen, you see something in other songs that other people do. And I think Grant finished that off for me.
Yeah, Grant just went in there and put in one of his fancy words.
Yeah.
My nickname is Evan Fancy, and so that's become. I tend to be a little bit flowery, and so, but that's also an interesting challenge. Like, I think our writing styles, you know, are also a little bit different, and we also keep, there's a house style that comes with the Sonic Bond books too. So we had to really keep all that stuff in check, and so I think what you get is a really decently, you know, sort of neutralized version of all three of our styles, and then what Sonic Bond wanted from us too, because they had a list of things that they required and lots of different formatting that was weird and unusual. Like, they wanted their full stops after quotation marks and things, and that's
That was me.
Oh, that was you. That's not how we write over here. That's not how we typically write in America. And so I think all those things are really interesting to sort of navigate. And, you know, we had some conversations about those and agreed to disagree. And, you know, that was just sort of, thank heavens we have things like Google Docs now where, you know, you can edit a common document. So we're not constantly firing edits back and forth. So that was, you know, kind of a lifesaver where we could go in and, you know, make real-time edits and not have to be concerned about, you know, did somebody see that? Was there, you know, how quickly does that get updated? So I think that was, I don't know how writers did that collectively before stuff like that was available. That would have been a tremendous challenge.
Neither do I. And that's it, but we did it for previously with Tales, didn't we?
You did.
Well, let's talk about this book itself. Yeah, this 1960s book. It covers the Australian years and the Bee Gees' first fame. So the book actually works out to be this great cliffhanger ending because the group breaks up and, you know, the next decade begins and who knows what's going to happen. What? Spoiler alert. Sorry, if you haven't read the book or paid attention in the past 50 years. you guys were kind of mentioning a little bit about how it's kind of, you know, a narrative about the storytelling of their lives, but then also breaks into then listings of songs. And then under the listings of songs, you have facts about the songs, but it's not like, I don't want to give the impression that it's a list. I was surprised. So you guys sent me a advanced copy PDF of the book earlier this week. And I spent the past 3 days doing nothing but binge reading this book.
It took you 3 days.
Well, I have two kids and a drinking problem, so that slowed me down.
Plus the punctuation issues.
What I was surprised at was how it did get me emotionally involved more than I expected. How it did connect me to the music, and it's not a textbook or a reference book, that it read very well. And I give you guys tremendous applause and props for being able to pull that balancing act off.
Thanks. We're happy with that. It's sort of a marriage of what, you know, Mark and Andrew did with, and others with the Tales book. And then Joe Brennan's original Gibbs Songs website. I mean, Joe was really the first person to sort of do that kind of song by song breakdown of everything. And I think Joe probably has less narrative about, you know, the songs built into them. There's some there, but, you know, his whole project was to basically collect them all, because I don't think anybody had done that to that extent before. And so, you know, a lot of credit goes to Joe, you know, for doing that original work, because, I mean, every Wikipedia entry that you read is all Joe stuff. And so people just pilfered it. And so, you know, he had a lot of credit goes to him for building that. Yeah. He was really, you know, the OG of that information. So, I think we were happy with how we built those in. And, you know, there's a larger story. There's not just their musical context, but there's also their personal lives. There's also a lot of societal stuff going on. And, you know, the Bee Gees career was long enough that it really reflected the history of pop music. And so, you know, when they were making music in the late 60s, I mean, their music was tied up in all of this, the stuff that was going on in the world, you know, anti-war demonstrations, economic issues, social issues, racial issues, sexual revolution, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so those songs didn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, they were, I think the Bee Gees get unfairly criticized for not writing substantially about the world, substantially about social issues. I think they, they've often said that they do, but they're abstract. And so, but you know, those songs weren't made in a vacuum. They were seeing and experiencing those things as well as young people. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think we felt a responsibility, as Marcus said before, to make sure that, you know, we reflected that. So there is some commentary in there about, you know, why these songs are important. You know, New York Mining Disaster is a great example of how it reflected the Aberfan disaster that happened in Wales, which really hadn't come recently into public consciousness again until folks started watching The Crown and there was an episode dedicated to that. And so, you know, yeah, so very interesting stuff. And so there's, yeah. You know, it's just some of those things that we wanted to make sure, you know, were a part of the narrative too, because like I say, they didn't just go into the studio. I mean, they were experiencing all the revolution happening in the world and continue to. So it was really fascinating to pull some of that stuff out.
Something else as well was the extensive detail about the Australian years. I know I get upset about having the 87 through 2001 get glossed over. I'm sure a lot of fans don't like the Australian years getting glossed over as it does, because as far as, you know, the documentaries know, they moved to Australia for a little bit and came back and boom, they were superstars. Mark, you're in Australia. You experienced a lot of that firsthand. Tell me about all the, like, not only the songs that they did, but all the people that they worked with while they were there for those years.
Well, what was extraordinary about is that they weren't that successful, but at the end of their recording era in Australia, they had a whole lot of people come in and record their songs in this studio they had free access to, and they'd left. And I would have been 12 then, which makes me about 30 now. It seems like the radio, it was like satellite 1978 again, because in 67 we had the Bee Gees, Tricks and Specs was still on the air being played, John Blanchfield, Ronnie Burns, little artists were having, the radio was awash with these songs which had been written by the Bee Gees. And people didn't realise then, that's what really struck me, man, because they'd spent so much time in the studio before they left, and all of a sudden in, what, January, March, Andrew, they started to come out. They weren't all hits, but they were on the radio. Ronnie Burns was an unknown out of Australia, but he was a very successful pop star in Australia, as the term was then, and he had two big hits in a row with Bee Gees song. They have a huge their impact here was extraordinary, particularly at that time. They really got their stuff together in terms of what was required to write a hit song. At that later in, you know, 66, they seemed to get it.
Now the underappreciation that they received in the 80s. Well, underappreciation is even lightly referring to what they experienced in the 80s, but that underappreciation kind of stems from the Australian years as well. They did all this work, they had all these great hits, but they weren't necessarily receiving the fame.
Well, the thing is, you got to remember, it'd be like similar to the Osmonds. Well, they grew up on our TV screens as children, and I don't think people quite took them seriously as they matured and became, you know, a group as such. A lot of people a little bit older than me saw them as kids in short pants singing songs. So when all of a sudden they started producing some good stuff, we just took them for granted. I didn't, because I hadn't seen them. They were older than me. So depending on what age group you speak in Australian, it depends on what their memories are of them. So, had they not left Australia, they would have had probably two hits and done the circuit for the rest of their life around here. Yeah.
And another interesting thing too that was brought up in the book was their presentation of their act was a novelty, was kind of an old school, because like we see now, I became a fan in the 90s after they had already become icons. So everything that I saw existed and I took for face value of what it was, you know what I mean? So when I see pictures of them from the Australia years singing in their suits, doing their little snap in their fingers, to me, that's what that time, that era was. But from what you guys say in the book, that was kind of 10 years older at that time too. So they kind of were already kind of a retro vibe type novelty act.
Yeah, going on. In here they were generalists. They had to be to survive. there just wasn't a bigger market yet to be able to do a bit of comedy, you know, it was kitsch and all that stuff. So they had to be. They did impersonations, they did this, all this sort of stuff. But
I think they had some sort of identity crisis, you know, and I think when folks went to hear their records, I mean, you know, if you saw them on TV doing, you know, comedy bits and saw them on stage doing, you know, covers and standards and musical, you know, numbers, and all of a sudden, you know, festivals trying to crank out these pop records that they were making that, you know, were trying to be, were paying tribute to the Beatles and other acts that they were being influenced by. And so I'm sure folks probably didn't know what to do with them at some point, you know, I think this comes back to, I think, where folks start to make unfair comparisons between the Bee Gees and the Beatles. And that's a perennial discussion, right? You know, I have to think that if the Bee Gees, you know, had a Brian Epstein and, you know, a George Martin to guide them through that early part of their career, I mean, things probably would have turned out a lot differently, but you also had Festival that wasn't super interested in helping them out. And so, you know, and if you listen to those recordings, I mean, the sound quality varies on them. The quality of the background instruments and things like that, you know, some of them sound really full and rich and others just sound like they were made in somebody's back, you know, garage. So it's just a fascinating sort of thing, but there was some really great stuff. Barry was an incredibly prolific songwriter for somebody who wasn't even 20 years old at that point. Right. And so, you know, nationally, I mean, he had a tremendous impact, and there was a reason why people were lining up to record his songs. And before the Bee Gees hit it big, I mean, he was already writing for songs for artists internationally, like Wayne Newton and, you know, folks like that. And so it was, you know, he accomplished a lot, but, you know, they had limitations, I think, where they were and, you know, who was there to support them. And you have to remember, too, Dad Hugh was also their manager. And so, you know, there were limitations, too, about how much, you know, Hugh could actually do for them as a manager. And, you know, it's I think all that played into why, you know, they weren't necessarily bigger and had more popularity. But
yeah. And I spoke to other musicians at the time, and they were very well regarded within the industry. You know, they did a lot of backup vocals. Their sound was required, and people couldn't understand why they weren't getting, you know, in the industry couldn't understand why they couldn't have the success. It was just, I think they had an image problem, is it? Because of the earlier work.
Well, clearly they hit their stride when they went back to England in 66, 67, whenever that was.
Read the book, you'll get the accurate information.
I don't have it directly in front of me. Spicks and Specks is a well-known legend of, you know, them on the ship hearing the news of it being number one. Too late to turn back now. We're already going on our way.
That's not true.
Right. Because
Yeah.
So that's exciting to read and discover that, you know, it's... You know, here are the facts, which is interesting. So,
Well, I think it's a good point that Andrew makes, and you know, David, I think this is something that, you know, we come across in this book, and I think we'll come across in future, are some of these corrections of narratives and timelines that we kind of bumped into as we've written. And so, you know, that's a good one where, you know, we're finding dates that, you know, we're sort of changing. You know, if you have a career as long as the Bee Gees did, you know, I think different versions of things will change. I mean, I think there's a running joke that Barry, Robin, and Morris, you know, never had the same story about anything and all the different memories of everything. And I think that happens. You know, a good one is, you know, regarding the narrative around Spicks and Specks. And for many, many years, people have talked about the fact that Spicks and Specks was their first number one, was a number one hit in Australia. And it actually wasn't. It was a top 10 hit. And actually, the first place where it hit number one was in New Zealand. And it didn't do that until 1967, after Bee Gees first had come out, when they were already in England and working on their second album. And so, you know, it's some of those little things, you know, that you come across in their history that become, you know, popular things that everybody says, and eventually they just reveal themselves to be untrue. And you have to kind of go back and go like, wait a minute, that didn't seem to fit in the timeline. So we made some of those discoveries as we went. And, you know, that was one of them. And I think those are important. We felt important to correct those things where we found them. And we had lots of discussions, I think, about some of that stuff.
I've been at Christmases where my father and his two sisters would get into arguments about facts from their childhood that they each remember differently. So I can only imagine this would be the same type of thing, but on a global public scale. So
yeah, for sure.
One of the other things that I wanted to mention about things that I saw that I was like, oh, this is interesting, that maybe I didn't know before, the Beatles wanting to sit in with the Bee Gees in one of their earlier sessions, but Robert Stigwood told them not to. And he said, quote, "I didn't think it would be particularly good." What? Did Robert Stigwood actually prevent the Fab Four and the Brothers Gibb from actually being in the same record studio?
What could have been? What could have been?
Yeah.
It's one of those strange ones. I don't know why he would have prevented that. The managers.
There's also a story that I think somebody suggested Andy Gibb's songwriting should be expanded. He should get some help along. He's writing on his own, and he suggested writing with John Oates. Is that right, Andrew? Mm-hmm. And Stigwood put the kibosh on that by saying, "Nah, let's keep it in the family." And it would have been so helpful for Andy, I think.
Yeah, it's strange. Like, sort of, Stigwood had a lot of control and probably too much. Like, sort of, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And I've always said that the Bee Gees have been the most mismanaged group in the history of popular music. You kind of think, you know, they were on such a roll, like, sort of, back in 77, 78, 79. And this is the example that I will always use, where they had the 6 number ones on the trot. But you think, why did they give If I Can't Have You away? Why did they give More Than a Woman away? If they had put those 2 singles out as the Bee Gees versions, we could have been talking 8 number ones on the trot there. People were just buying product. And let's face it, without any bias here, the Bee Gees versions of those 2 songs are far superior to the ones by Elliman and Tavares. You know?
Well, as somebody who you know, started listening to the Bee Gees in the 90s, I didn't know that the other 2 versions would have been the singles and the Bee Gees versions were, you know, released later or were just released on the greatest album. I had always just assumed that those were the versions. So yeah, they definitely should have been. They are far superior and, you know, they were the hottest act in the world. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, but there were lots of other decisions, you know, over the years, and it goes beyond the Stigwood era. Lots of there were other things, lots of which, in my opinion, lots of have been done incorrectly. But there's another book in that, The Bee Gees, The Way It Should Have Been. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think, David, as we've kind of gone through, I mean, there are always more questions than answers, and so, you know, you'll notice that sometimes we use the words reportedly and supposedly, and allegedly, you know, things like that. So, you know, things that multiple folks have told us or that we've learned from, you know, people who are close to them or from different sources. I mean, we always have to be careful about that. But, you know, all those questions kind of exist, like the one about, you know, the Beatles and the Bee Gees being in the same studio together about, you know, often we just have no explanation for why that didn't happen. And so that becomes the tough part about writing a book like this is, you know, the speculation. And, you know, the Bee Gees have been sort of secretive about a lot of things throughout their career. You know, they haven't sort of had a tell-all where, you know, they'll come back and start dispelling myths and things like that. They just, that wasn't part of their public existence. And so, and even Barry now, you know, is kind of tight-lipped about some of the things that happened in the past. And so, you know, it becomes hard when you're a writer and you're examining their career to really either sometimes affirm or dispel issues or rumors or get answers to questions. I mean, we could probably spend years with a list of 1,000 questions that we might have about, some, and I don't know that we'll ever find the answers. So, you know, some of the stuff we write about is really rhetorical, being like, what could this have been? And why did this happen? We don't know, you know? And so that's a big challenge when you're writing about a group that hasn't always shared or been really revelatory about, you know, some of those things. So it's been interesting.
Look, I noticed when I interviewed a lot of the Australian artists, you end up telling them what you want to hear because they can't remember. It's such a long time ago. And you've got to really stop when you've got to be, when you're interviewing them, you've got to say, well, I'm telling you, you're not telling me, but you've got to prompt them with them. Because it's a long time ago and they've done a lot of things since. And even Barry, what a life he's had. Who could blame him for getting, what was a hit record and what wasn't a hit record or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Or things like, oh, yeah, we always loved them back then.
Yeah.
It's like, did other people know that you loved them back then and all that stuff? So, but you guys are talking about, talking with people that worked with them or sources that knew them. You have two people who wrote forewords for this book that are as close to the Bee Gees as you could get. One was a Bee Gee. Of course, I'm talking about Spencer Gibb, Robin's son, and Vince Maloney, who was the guitarist for the original five-piece Bee Gees band. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like talking with them and working with them on this book and for these forewords and contributions to the book?
I guess I could probably talk about Spencer. Spencer and I have a really good relationship, and so we've become friends over the past few years. He's been very kind to help me out with a lot of different things, and I will sing some of Spencer's praises. He's an incredibly down to earth, generous individual, and so he's been really instrumental. I mean, Spencer shares stories with me. There are some things that I will talk about, and some things that I won't. Based on that conversation, but he's been involved, he's seen bits and pieces of the book and, has interjected a couple of things here and there, for that will probably show up a little bit further. I mean, Spencer wasn't alive during the 1960s. So, I think he addresses that in his forward a little bit that, he sort of loves that music much in the same way that fans do, in the sense that, even though it was something that his dad created with his uncles, that, he wasn't there to viscerally sort of experience it. And so, he's sort of like the rest of us, that he sort of has admired it from afar, or at least maybe a little bit closer than the rest of us have. But, Spencer,
what's the difference of afar? Is a close?
I think so. A close or afar. Yes. Spencer has had a really interesting, life as a member of the Gibb family, but he, he's a working musician and an artist and a photographer. And so, he's very much his own entity now. But he'll point things out and, talk about, that opening stretch on the documentary where they show the limousines driving towards the stadium in Dallas where they perform, during the Spirits Having Flown tour. He's like, yep, that was me. I was in the second limo, or, and so it's just fun to hear some of that stuff. And so when I asked Spencer to write that, because I think he has, of course, a really affectionate and knowledgeable perspective as a member of the Gibb family. But, Spencer's also a musician and a fan of music, just like the rest of us are. And so I think he also has some really objective, opinions about some of that music, and just like the rest of us do. And so that was, those are conversations he and I have pretty frequently. So when he wrote the foreword, you see that very much reflected, that I think he can talk about the fact that, yes, I've been a part of the Gibb family and I know intimately sort of a lot about what they did and because I was there. But there are other places where, he talks about the Bee Gees music and, very much as sort of a person outside looking in, and has a really good sort of lens about, the music quality and, what went into making those records and the technical things, because he's an engineer and a producer and he understands that. So, so that was really important perspective, I think, for us to have. And so we've had lots of great conversations about this book and about others. So that was, it just seemed, like a no-brainer to ask him to write the foreword. And of course he certainly did that, which was great of him. So thanks, Spencer.
Awesome. And all right. And then of course, also Vince Maloney is also one of the foreword writers. Can Andrew, Mark, speak a little bit about including Vince in on this book?
I'll go on that one if I may. I hooked up with Vince a few years ago now, when he was part of the Italian Bee Gees tour in Germany. So I did about a week on the road with them. That was just when Blue Weaver and Dennis Bryan were part of the band. Vince wasn't aboard at that point. And then, of course, they announced that Vince was going to be on. So I decided to go to Berlin for a week, and I hooked up with them again. And I actually got a seat on the bus next to Vince. And when we went to a restaurant after the gig, it was bizarre. None of this was planned. I had Dennis sitting on one side, I had Blue sitting on the other side, and I had Vince sitting across the way to me. Lots of it was, whoa, what's going on here? it was just totally, totally bizarre, but it was fantastic. It was great, great stuff. Anyway, the next morning at the hotel, I sat down with Vince and had a 5-hour chat with him about the Australian years and the 67 through 68 era. Got it all recorded. It was fantastic. And he's such a nice guy. Well, sort of really, really softly spoken. Still got that Australian accent, very, very mild Australian accent. And just such a nice man. So when we were writing this book, Grant said, I'll see if I can get Spencer to do something for us. And then I thought, well, are there any real rules involving forward writing? can't we have two forward writers? So I made an approach via his social media account. I've got Vince's personal details, but I thought I'll go in via Vince Maloney Music. And Jonathan, who runs that for him, Jonathan of the Jigsaw Scene and now the Tall Poppy Syndrome, has been extremely helpful as a go-between. And Vince recorded some more quotes for us to use for the book, and he wrote the foreword for us. Again, I added some punctuation.
we know Mark didn't do it.
And Vince has kindly agreed to sign a number of books for us. Those books
God that sold
directly through our website, bgsdecades.com. We've sold a number of books through that. I've taken delivery of them today. Vince at the moment is on tour with the Italian Bee Gees. So that tour ends on the 19th of November. The following week, I hope he will be back in the UK and I can see a road trip coming on. So I'm going to be heading south and getting those signed. And just as soon as they are, they're all going to be winging their ways to all corners of the globe.
So one of those is going to be coming here. Yeah, one of those is going to be coming here to me, and I can't wait. I'm excited to get that as well. So that's really cool.
So we've already been discussing who we'd like to do the 70s, 80s, and 90s, haven't we? We've targeted a few people, so we're not going to even mention who they are, because you'll only be disappointed if they say no.
It's true.
Yeah, that's understandable. Do you have any other kind of teases that you could give our listeners or our viewers for the 70s or 80s books, 90s books?
Gets his little notepad out.
There's
a few little things that I've been working on.
I'm interested to hear these too, because I'm not sure that I know. So,
I've mentioned these. Mark might not know about them, but lots of it, because he ducked out of our last Zoom conference.
I was gone.
Mark was a little under the weather when we last time we met. So yeah,
it's wind. That's what it was. I've done a bit of background work on singer read song, and it's interesting how old the project actually was. It took about 9 years to develop to what it actually was. which is quite unbelievable that it turned out so badly. There are also things that we will be revealing. If you take a look at Joe Brennan's website, you'll see a song called Bunker in there. And we will be revealing what exactly Bunker was and what the song developed into. There's something.
Is it a song that we know?
Maybe. There's also something that we got rather excited about a couple of months ago. There's a collaboration with one of the Hollies and a steel band. That was quite an interesting one. We've heard the music. There's also quite a lengthy piece that I've written about Crimson, a band called Crimson, not King Crimson. It's a band called Crimson. And
Rupert Crimson?
Rupert. they developed into something else as well. But there is part of that story which culminated in the only record ever released on the Moby Productions record label. So those are a few things. And we're only up to 1974. Thanks to Grant and his contacts, I think we've got a couple of rather interesting interviewees coming up, haven't we, Grant?
We do, yeah. We have a few folks that I think we're going to try to talk to and get some more insight and things like that. You know, the 70s is always interesting because it's the chunk of the Bee Gees career that's always talked about the most. But, you know, it's interesting to me how little time or how little there is available to some folks about those recordings and how they were made. And so, you know, I wrote some articles for Albumism in the past few years that really go into depth. Albie Gold and Carl Richardson are two folks that I connect with fairly regularly, really great guys. And every technical nuance that you ever wanted to know about those albums, I mean, incredible. So I know that there'll be more of those things for folks to discover on some of those projects that, you know, I think folks know very well on the surface level, and things they've seen in films and, you know, things like that. But
just that new documentary had them and showed the drum loop stuff that they were talking about looping and that was fascinating. And it was just a little part of that documentary. I could have watched a half an hour worth of them just explaining that stuff.
Yeah. That drum loop got a lot of mileage. That drum loop was used, you know, of course on Staying Alive, but also More Than a Woman, Woman in Love. They maximized the heck out of that thing and probably used it in more ways than they could probably even remember. So that little creation that they made, had a long life. it really was an innovation. I mean, nobody had done that to that point. And I mean, Albie and Carl are really geniuses. Albie right now works for Sony. Albie invented the, some form of CD. It was the one where there was content. So it was the CD-ROM versions of CDs. So when you used to buy an album and on the flip side, there would be, you know, videos and content that you put into your CD-ROM drive. I mean, Albie invented that. So, he's not just a producer. I mean, the guy is, I mean, really, he's a brain and a half. He sort of mesmerizes me talking to him. They can't remember song titles, but, you know, sometimes they can. But they know, you know, we used this splice of tape and it was this long and it had this detail and it was this long, you know, they know, they remember all that stuff. It's amazing. It truly is.
That's the stuff that I love. And as a Bee Gees nerd, I've always thought about like little snippets of the song that sound like something. I'm like, what is that something? That sounds like somebody saying something played backwards or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's always the stuff that I'm like, I need more information about that. And it's never found anywhere. So thank you for finding those things for us.
There'll be more.
Awesome. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining me. I am excited to get the physical copy of the book in my hands, and good luck with writing the rest of the series.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it, David.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
And many more.